Welcome to the Placeholder Podcast, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. Joining me today, Johnny Long.
Yeah, sorry, I thought we were doing the non-talking thing, but we're here, and I'm ready to go. I'm pumped. I've had a day already.
Ronan McLaughlin.
I am caffeinated to the max. Ready to go.
Ooh, ready to go. Kit Nicholson, are you drinking an alcoholic beverage?
I'm not sure I like this reputation, but no, I'm not today. It's only crabbies.
Quick question. Ronan being caffeinated to the max, I thought that happened at the Ross. And if that is the case, then I hope that's not happened because you're currently inside your nice house.
That the Ross was merely training. That has increased my threshold and my tolerance for caffeine, so I can push even higher than, what was that, 1,500, 2,000 milligrams? Otherwise known as 2 grams of caffeine.
That sounds terrifying. Anyway, let's get into today's show. We got a good one for you. We're talking the end of September. September. Intermarché's troubles, Caleb Ewan's future, Trek and Roglic, got a little bit more on that, and some weekly pain at the end of today's show. It's going to be a jam-packed one for you. Let's get into the Vuelta first and foremost. It's Tuesday today. Vuelta wrapped up over the weekend. Sepp Kuss is your Vuelta a España winner, the first American winner since Chris Horner. I wish people could see faces. I feel like we have discussed this particular angle, the Sepp Kuss angle, at length, but obviously there's a couple things that have happened since our last emergency podcast end of last week. First and foremost is that we had the sort of Jumbo-Visma turnaround, the PR push, the branding efforts all around GC Kuss. They kind of embraced that. They had stickers made up. They had a special bike. The other thing they had done was they had that special kit made up, because they won all 3 Grand Tours this year. So they had that new kit with
a yellow stripe
and a pink stripe and a red stripe, one for each Grand Tour victory. I also saw Dan Benson posted a photo of somebody's laptop showing Jumbo-Visma's sort of 2023 goals at the beginning of the season for the men's team, and they achieved almost all of them. It was like win Flanders, win or Roubaix, win all 3 Grand Tours, a couple of things. They've done something that I don't think has ever happened before in the history of the sport. And they did it at the end also by winning or by taking the entire podium at the Vuelta. We're going to get a little bit more into kind of how we feel about the Jumbo dominance, I think, later in the show. But let's kick off with this weekend. So what else went down over the weekend that was notable to you three?
Well, before the champagne, there was, Remco Evenepoel, as you know, as certain as death and taxes, he got in a breakaway. And it was great. Caden Groves followed him. Ganna followed him. Kemna, Dens, and Rui Costa were all up the road. So you had six riders who were all Grand Tour stage winners so far this year, 5 of them from this race. And it was great. It was great fun. The peloton had a real trouble. So that, you know, usually you sit down for the last stage of a Grand Tour and think, okay, let's just get to the end now. But yeah, I enjoyed that. I wasn't expecting to enjoy it quite so much.
Did the Jumbo-Visma social admin crack? Did they break? Did their brain break? Because there was like that weird post with a dog and some couscous, which we think that's where the couscous came from, right, Kit?
Yeah, I found this incredibly funny. And it just kind of capped off the whole week. Because, I don't know, we all know what happened. Jumbo-Visma social admin had to manage that, the outlook for the team. And it steadily got more and more deranged, culminating in, I don't know how to describe it really, a very small dog going to town on a very large bowl of some nondescript food. It was disgusting. But if you click on the alt text of the GIF, the description was GC couscous, which means that whoever's behind that laptop screen or phone or whatever, however they do their job, searched GC Kuss just for kicks, found that ridiculous GIF and thought, that'll do. And that was how they signed off on the Vuelta, basically.
So what you're saying,
we've all been there with the that'll do moment. Like, you know, especially at the end of a 3 week Vuelta, that's 4 weeks for whoever's rolling the press there for the team on the ground. So you can understand how that can happen. But still.
I think they should probably pay more if the riders and team are going to act like that. Because you can't tweet your way out of these sort of situations, because the thing to do in all situations is not tweet.
I did notice
that he has to tweet because it's his job. So I'm not surprised that he put the disgusting photo of the dog on there. My only desire is that he did do quite a lot of like Jumbo Visma riders drinking. But I would want him to go even harder on that and just see how far he can push Richard Plugger.
Yeah, the champagne showers were spectacular.
It was good, wasn't it? But
yeah, Kuss knows how to operate a champagne bottle.
Yeah, but they were like directly spraying each other like in the eyes, and it looked like quite painful. And I thought like midway through watching it, that'd be the perfect point to put your sunglasses on, and also that would just look much cooler. I feel like with those like crazy.
Johnny, you should be working on PR, man. What are you doing with us? You should be working in PR with a thought like that. Like, forget your watches that are stuck on the single screen. Put your sunglasses on so you don't get champagne in your eyes. It's a sponsor's dream. How has somebody not come up with this before? Like, how have we not seen that like in every sport on the planet at this point?
It'd be good.
You'd think, right? As a means, or the old, remember the Peter Sagan goggles, like the motor goggles he used to put on the side of his head? Yeah. I mean, talk about the best way to protect your eyes from champagne, a set of moto goggles.
Yeah, that should be standard issue for Binyam Girmay.
So long story short here is that the Jumbo had a really fascinating week, and I would say that some of the staff behind the scenes probably had a pretty fascinating week last week because, yeah, I mean, they were getting absolutely pounded from all sides. Just whacked in the face from all sides all last week. And I mean, the argument has certainly been made that essentially the team acquiesced to public pressure more so than acquiesced to any internal pressure, right? And I think that is potentially accurate. I was even watching like all the meme accounts over the weekend were sort of patting themselves on the back, like, we did this, congratulations to us, which I very much enjoyed. And there's some truth to that, right? Like, you know, it wasn't the meme accounts, it wasn't sites like ours, it wasn't any particular thing, it was sort of all of it combined pushed a team to do something that it felt like they wouldn't have otherwise done. Like, if everyone hadn't sort of yelled about it, Jonas Vingegaard would have won that Vuelta, right?
Nah. I like to think they wouldn't have. He wouldn't have. They did. The Kuss was in as good. I think on the Angliru, that was. I mean, it was one of the hardest to watch stages. But his gap was small by the end over Vingegaard. But I think on that day, at least the way that I've been interpreting, thinking about it in my head, the optimist that I try to be, is that earned him the right to be the leader. It was like, okay, we tried, couldn't drop you. We'll help you out now. And by helping him out, really, all I mean is they just let the breakaways enjoy the rest of the race.
I would like to give him the benefit of the doubt also, but I just struggle to.
It was so tight, right? Like you have to think they would have. Well, I don't know. We're talking hypotheticals here. We'll never really know. But nonetheless, I think it was just a kind of astonishing week because of that question, regardless of which direction you answer that question. Like the fact that it is possible that essentially fan outcry led to a tactical shift within what is now the biggest, most successful team in all of pro cycling. That is something that is, well, it's not something that I think we're going to see again anytime soon.
It also just goes to show, I mean, yeah, they gave us a lot more drama than even their dominance might have suggested, but it also just showed how anonymous and absent everybody else was in that GC race, because Juan Ayuso did a lot of, well, he was on the front a lot.
GC race?
well, yeah, news to me too, Renan, but Juan Ayuso and Enric Mas and that lot, you know, they occasionally attacked in the last few hundred meters, but that was just to kind of, I don't know, get a nice view of the finish line. It was quite sad, really, that it was so anonymous. And, you know, Enric Mas, well, he should have won last year, in my opinion. He should have had, he would have won, would have if he had better technical nous. I don't know, but let's not go back to last year. But yeah, so it was just, it, just the whole week. You look at the GC at the weekend and it's like, oh yeah, there were some other riders racing, like Mikel Landa and Juan Ayuso and Kjaan Uijtebroeks. And Vlasov.
And Vlasov.
Attacking his own teammate
exactly.
again.
Exactly, yeah.
I think the interesting thing about the like the fan pressure or whatever is that we don't usually get it in cycling because there's no, all the teams and riders and stuff aren't, and races aren't beholden to like sections or the fans. Like you have, there's that Belgian one day race that always used to do those like horrible sexist posters, but then they're just like, okay, fine, we'll finally stop doing it well after the fact. Yeah. But nothing like happens. And, or if a rider does something, it's like, oh, they just find another team or, whereas like in football, for instance, recently you've had like horrible stories where teams have tried to keep players who have like done or are accused of doing bad things, and then fan pressures forced them out of the club. Or like a couple of years ago you had the whole Super League thing where the clubs are trying to do that, and then fan pressure and media pressure all back that down. So it's actually nice to see it can work in cycling, and we're not just like outside of this vast aquarium peering in at all the weird cycling shaped fish.
I mean, it points to how passionate the entire fan base got. And that's not something that's really normal, right? Like I would say most of cycling fandom is generally built on sort of individual fandom more so than team fandom, perhaps, at least in sort of the English speaking world. I think maybe slightly different in places like Belgium, probably slightly different in the Netherlands and with Jumbo. But yeah, in the English speaking world, it tends to be individual rider fandom. And I think that's kind of what we saw. And it's almost like situational, contextual, right? Like the context of last week really mattered to all of a sudden making every single bike racing fan of the planet a Sepp Kuss fan, right? Like it didn't start the Vuelta that way. It was the context of that particular moment that sort of enraged this massive group of people. And yeah, ended up, I think, at the very least, shifting a tactic. You can argue forever whether that actually changed the end result, but the tactic was certainly shifted on the back of a fair amount of pressure, of an enormous amount of pressure.
It was also absolutely in their interest. I absolutely agree that the social media had an impact, and they would have felt, you know, just the idea of Vingegaard winning this weekend. Yeah, he might have been the strongest at the race, and people have argued about that. You know, if there isn't a race for the overall, then what's the point in watching? But cycling is a team sport, and there have been countless times when, you know, the second or third best rider has been guided to the finish. But you know, if they had knocked Sepp Kuss off the top step, they've said themselves that he is the key to the, or he has been the key to their Grand Tour successes over the past few years. It would have been a massive implosion, and you know, we all know that Sepp Kuss, part of the reason that Sepp Kuss might have suffered under the pressure of Roglic and Vingegaard was that he's just too nice. And obviously fans like him for that. He gives a good interview. He's got a nice persona. He is, you know, one of the sporting heroes that people love to see and that you wouldn't mind having your younger brothers or sisters or children supporting. But yeah, if that had happened, if Kuss had had it robbed, it would have been really bad for the team themselves going forward too, potentially. Maybe Sepp Kuss is just too nice to even let that affect him. But you've got to imagine it would.
I feel like Jonas Vingegaard realized that quite quickly, and Primoz Roglic maybe still hasn't fully comprehended it.
Yeah.
that was the sense that I got from the end of the Vuelta.
Yeah, definitely.
Vingegaard, like literally from the, even the end of the Angleroo, and definitely the next morning, he's like, no. I want Sepp to win. I want nothing to do with this. And he very quickly realized what the PR ramifications of that were. And meanwhile, Roglic is sort of over the side, like, we race. We race up the mountains. We see what happens.
I was just going to sort of reiterate the context around the scenario that unfolded that we're unlikely to ever see ever again. Not just three riders in one team on the podium, not just the same team winning all three Grand Tours in the 1 year, but the loyal lieutenant who has, you know, you talk about the strongest rider winning the race, Sepkus time and time again has sacrificed his chances of winning individual stages to help these other two grand champions who have already won multiple Grand Tours each. And yet somehow that loyal lieutenant, who in theory is supposed to be the lesser of the three riders, finds himself in the lead. And those other two grand champions then can't return the favor that he's. So all that it just made for this scenario that we're, you know, unlikely to ever see again. And I think, you know, if we're talking as well about Vinigo realizing what was unfolding and changing tack pretty quickly, I still come back to the fact that it never should have happened in the first place, and that if Jumbo were bringing Vinigo and Roglic, they couldn't have anticipated what Kuss was going to do. But if they're bringing Vinigo and Roglic to that, to the Vuelta, a conversation needs to happen in advance of what's going to happen if the two of them find themselves fighting out for the red jersey, because it was almost inevitable. And then, you know, had that conversation happened, it easily, you know, swap out one of the riders for Kuss, or swap out both riders for Kuss, or whatever. That conversation is much easier in advance rather than trying to wind the clock back and decide it after you've got three guys onto the podium and all the sort of complexity that comes with that. But the other thing for Jumbo was, like, did somebody not realize that Primoz Roglic is turning 34 this year and Jonas Vingegaard was still, like, what, 25 or 26? So has theoretically his best years ahead of him, has already won two tours. At some point, they just need to be ruthless and say, Vinigo is our guy, not only for winning the tour, but winning 10 tours in the next 10 years. And as much as it might upset Roglic, we need to keep Vinigo happy. So then it was like, as soon as Vinigo was happy for Kuss to win, that's what should have happened. So I think the whole thing could have just been not only handled better, but avoided to start with.
Yeah, on your point about the leadership, the characters at the top, and particularly Roglic, I think it was a perfect example. It's like a live action BuzzFeed quiz. What type of rider are you? Because you have Roglic and Vingegaard, Roglic especially, being that sort of extreme killer instinct, winner takes all, go for it 100%, never mind the consequences. And then you've got Kuss, who's just nice guy. He's like, I think I deserve to win this, but, you know, it is what it is. I think that was a really stark, and we really, really saw the extreme versions of those caricatures in the last week.
It reminded me of a story that I heard when I first got into cycling like 20 years ago about Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach. I think it was in the Nissan Classic, and I might not have the facts straight here, so forgive me if I don't, but it was something along the lines of the two grand champions of the day in their home stage race near the end of the season, and they could sort of divvy out stage wins between them to a certain extent. And I think a deal was done one day that Kelly had said to Roach or something, you let me win today's stage and I'll help you win a stage. And Roach agreed to that. And then the next day, Kelly went and took his second stage in a row. And Roach's argument afterwards was like, I thought you were going to help me to win a stage. And Sean said something to the effect of, I said I would help you win a stage. I didn't say I would help you win today's. So it's kind of like that killer instinct that, yes, I have, for Roglic, yes, I have 3 or 4 or 10 Vueltas to my name already, however many it is. But he still wanted another, and he, you know, it didn't matter what got in the way. And I suppose the way he's thinking about it is, I might not be in this team next year. I don't really have to think all that much about these people's, how they're going to feel about me going forward or whatever.
I've only got a couple more things on this. When we've been talking about, we can't believe that they didn't like ask the question and decide this beforehand. If you've seen that, the picture Daniel Benson tweeted of the presentation at the start of the season, I can now buy in more of like the sort of organized chaos theory, because that presentation looked like it sucked. Like, I don't have a real job, I don't make presentations, but I know that's not how it's supposed to look. It's just like someone one day was like, oh, what do we want to do this season? Win like all the Grand Tours and Paris-Bay and da-da-da. That was mad. And then in hindsight, one of the biggest travesties would have been that we wouldn't have got to see Sepkus sing the national anthem. Maybe this is just because I'm like big into the American national anthem at the minute. like watching Americans sing it. It's just fascinating. But just like him up on the podium with Roglic and Vingegaard at the side, like, what the fuck is this? Was great. And he did that, and he really went for the and the home of the brave bit, which I always appreciate.
you gotta sing the. It's a good anthem. You have to admit,
it is a great anthem.
There's some real crap anthems out there. It's a pretty good anthem.
British rubbish.
It was pretty not shocking to me, but stark. The difference between the reaction to this win and Chris Horner's win in 2013, which I was working at VeloNews at the time. I was working for the major American cycling publication. And for many reasons, some of which we can't really say on air, but relate to rumors around things like redacted riders in the Reason decision and things like that. There was just very little. It was a very muted response. It was a very muted response to Chris Horner's Vuelta victory. Certainly, absolutely nothing like what we saw in the last week. Certainly, absolutely nothing like what we saw over the weekend. And I think it's a good thing. I think like this is a much healthier response to, the first Grand Tour win for a country in 10 years. It's a much healthier response.
Interesting you say that. I remember that Horner winning, I think it was 2013, wasn't it? And I was, yeah, at the time, it probably wasn't in my peak Vuelta fandom period. That might have been like 05, 06 before Roberto Heras was caught and all that, but just as I was getting into cycling. But definitely 2013. I was a big Vuelta fan at the time. I was living in Belgium at the time, so I had nothing to do. I also wasn't getting selected for teams at the time, so I doubly had nothing to do in a house with nothing but a TV. And it was kind of one of those, you just like, you watched the Vuelta like it was, you were watching the news or something in a country that you didn't really care about what the news was. This is a bit different this time around, yeah.
Hugely different.
I think Chris has been the perfect sort of person to diffuse like the domination for Jumbo-Visma, because you've got, he's like, traditionally he's been a guy who has bad days and like struggles to put it all together for his own sort of chances, and coming off the back of like Vingegaard's total dominance of the tour, that time trial, everything, any sort of valid questions associated with dominance, I think Sepp Kuss actually come in, and for all the PR blunders, him winning the Vuelta has, like, if Vingegaard Roglic wins the Vuelta, there's less of a good news story to follow. So then I think everyone naturally then goes down the path of like, we need to ask. And the questions were asked at the end in Madrid, at like final press conferences and stuff. But I think it would have been very different had it been one of the main guys just dominating again, instead of it being like, oh, and Kuss can also do it.
And Kuss did get the sort of domination question, basically the doping question. Right, he basically had a doping question. His answer was really interesting, which was essentially it was an unusual answer. I'm paraphrasing here, but it was basically, you have to be prepared to lose, and I think that the dangerous thing is if you're not prepared to lose, and that you have to like accept losing, and that's not something we hear from the sort of top champions all that frequently. Response to that particular question is like his defense is basically like, I am able to accept when a rider is better than me. And if you actually sort of boil down the real crux of the doping question, that's a quite insightful thing, because like when I look at riders, the riders I worry about doping most are the ones who seem sort of physically incapable of losing, right? Like they have this sort of insane, I think you can say insane, need to win stuff. Those are the ones that you feel like would probably pull out all the stops at some point to make sure that keeps happening. Whereas Kuss's response, I think, is a much more measured, much more reasonable, much more believable response than I think we've heard from most. And to Vingegaard's credit, I think Vingegaard and Kuss have had the two best answers to that question in the last half decade, basically.
Yeah, although at least Kuss didn't say like he wouldn't give his kid drugs. It's nice to get that a bit more sort of nuance. That was weird.
I was talking more about Vingegaard's last year, not this summer, true. Which was much more nuanced. Yeah, it was a fascinating response to that question.
Bingo was just building up to the weird dog meme. He's just like, I'll say something weird about my kid, and then we'll get to the dog meme at the end of the world.
I don't know. Chris's response didn't really do it for me, to be honest. I thought it was just a bit... I think as a cyclist, you kind of have to be pretty good at losing anyway. Even if you're Mark Cavendish at your peak, you're going to lose 90% of the races you start or whatever it might be. But I admit that I don't want to be critical of it. It was, at least it wasn't that old chestnut, I've never tested positive. But I read it and it didn't move the needle for me, but that would be a terrible, terrible turn of phrase to use for this subject.
It was not original. Media trained, yeah. Well, it might. It was media trained, but it wasn't like regurgitated nonsense.
I appreciated it. Yeah, I think maybe just because it was something that we haven't really heard before. It was like a vulnerability that they don't usually, that like sort of, you know, Grand Tour winners do not generally use in these like immediate post-race interview kind of situations.
He is a very good speaker, and it kind of, what I find most interesting as the Vuelta progressed was his almost like a shift in his, reading between the lines, you could sense a shift in his mentality from starting off purely in support of the other riders to, this is great, I have the jersey, I get to down some champagne, to, I want my chance. And I just, you know, not to go back to the whole conversation we just had, but when we're talking about his post-stage or post-race press conferences, you kind of do wonder what everyone done in the background, is it going to influence Kuss's thoughts going forward? And I think about 2 weeks ago, we had speculated no matter what happened at the Vuelta, even if he won it, it probably wouldn't change who he is, and he probably would slot back into that domestic role. But with the way it went, and it would be especially interesting if we knew what actually happened behind the scenes, of which unfortunately we don't, but you know, is there anything to be gleaned from his post-stage press conferences that suggests that maybe he won't be as loyal next season? Or he might be as loyal, but he might not be as willing to go to, you know, falling still at the side of the road. He's emptied himself that much for his leader or whatever. I don't know. If I was to take anything from what he said after stages, that was more what I was hearing than, or that was doing more for me than the I am happy to lose piece.
I think it's time we take a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Dane Cash. You may have seen my byline over at escapecollective.com, and I'm also a podcast host, and I'm taking the opportunity provided by this little break in the action of the podcast you're listening to right now to tell you that if you like bike racing and you want some pretty serious analysis, you should check out the Pretty Serious Bike Racing Podcast. Every week, I chat with my co-host Cosmo Catalano and a few other extremely talented analysts, and we break down all the big stories in the pro racing scene. You hear from former road pros like Abby Mickey, Ruth Winder, and Rona McLaughlin, and from insightful cycling journalists like Kaylee Fretz, Johnny Long, and Kit Nicholson. We try to dive deep into the racing action to talk tactics, smart moves by some riders, questionable decisions by others, unheralded members of the pro peloton, and a lot more. And despite my best efforts to keep us very serious, you can rely on Cosmo and the rest of our crew to keep the serious level down just to where it's just pretty serious, the perfect amount of serious. You can find the pod on the main Escape Collective podcast feed, and we hope you'll check it out. All right, back to the show.
All right, time for a couple quick news hits here. There's lots of other stuff happening in the world of bicycles outside of the Vuelta. Intermarché haven't been paying riders properly. Who wants to take this one?
Go on then. Story came out today, which is we're recording on Tuesday, saying Intermarché Circus Wanty reprimanded by UCI over late wage payments. The CEO has blamed sponsored delays in late payments in July, August, and September, and has said the team has no budget problems. Basically, it sounds like it's just one of those things when you're sponsored by massive companies and things just take ages to happen sometimes, and you know, you can get delays, and I guess they probably run quite a tight sort of budget sheet. When you've got like that many title sponsors and your kit looks like that, I guess that is the case. So nothing necessary to worry about, and they fessed up to the UCI that they had been late in paying riders, and then the UCI turned around and were like, well, now we have to reprimand you, which just seems one of those weird things, but I guess you know, UCI needs something to do. But there were like rumours that maybe this is the start of murmurings over, because Belgium is bringing in sort of new restrictions on gambling sponsorships. So Circus, which is some sort of gambling company, their contribution's going down a lot and they're going to lose a lot of money from that. And like Target riders, they want to sign like Oliver Narsen, aren't coming over now. And like there's a lot of staff leaving, but the CEO says that's just normal. So not great, but who knows? Maybe it's just the Belgian media being like, well, Remco Evenepoel's finished the Vuelta now, we need something else to write about. So let's go mad on this one. Hopefully it's all okay.
Yeah, something to keep an eye on. Never a good sign. And that team has sort of punched above its weight for the last couple of years. Although this year is a little bit less successful, I think, than last season, where they had a couple of pretty big wins. Still, a shame to see it. Next on the list here, where's Caleb Ewan going? Obviously, a lot of destiny, not having their best season, not having their best kind of half decade, if we're perfectly honest. What's Caleb Ewan up to, and where's he off to, potentially?
Basically, Caleb Ewan's spoken out for the first time since the Lotto Destiny CEO, Stefan Hulot, I think is how you pronounce it, basically dug him out for giving up at the tour and things going wrong. And it's like, well, there's a bunch of other stuff going on in your team and underperformance, so you can't just lay it all at his door. And then Ewan's agent at the time hit back and was like, you can't say this. And now Ewan's sort of in the middle ground of being like, I want to stay, probably for the final year's contract, probably because it's a massive contract. Lotto Destiny want him out the door to free up budget, and they just like are thinking all the bridges are burned. And Ewan's like, maybe I'll go somewhere else, but right now I'm staying here. So hopefully he gets what he wants, and also that if he ends up staying for next year, they don't just send him around a bunch of like 1 point pro racers.
Isn't that all linked to the change of bike sponsor for Lotto Destiny, and that I think Ridley were covering quite a considerable chunk, if not all, of Caleb Ewan's salary, and Lotto needed extra money to cover Arnaud Delis' new contract, and so Orbea came in covering Arnaud Delis' new contract, but not, you know, they've Lotto have then lost Ridley's money. They're not going to get Ridley's money if they're riding Orbea bikes. So I think there's a whole mess going on in the background there. I don't know how accurate all that is, but that's certainly what the rumors are.
Well, they should have thought about it. And then also at the weekend, one of their sports directors on the development team was trying to get back onto the race route through like a train crossing. And the signalman was obviously like, no, you can't because it's closed and there's a train coming. He's like, but I need to be in like the GP Rick Van Looy. And the signalman was like, no, don't care. And then the sports director like apparently hit him and has now been suspended by the team. So just every time something this team can like just add to the bad vibes that's going on, it kind of happens.
It's a shame for Ewan that Dylan Groenewegen has his sprinter's seat on the bus at Jayco, because that would be, I would imagine that he might even have had a conversation with them already. I mean, both of their contracts are up at the end of 2024. Groenewegen and Ewan.
So big old switcheroo.
Maybe.
Have we got any lighter stories than people not getting paid and things going wrong?
You've got one. Where's Mark Cavendish?
Oh, where's Cav? I more wrote that down on our press.
Is this the return of Cavwatch?
I can tell you where Cav is.
Oh, where is he?
Cav is going on training rides with Israel Premier Tech social media manager Chris Room.
Ah.
Yeah, that's the news about Cav. He's on his bike.
What are they training for? Because neither of them have raced in quite a while. Well, obviously Cav was injured following a tour, but and he is back training though, I guess, after what was collarbone break, wasn't it?
Mm.
Cav is definitely going to re-sign with Astana, because Michael Morcu is out at Soudal Quickstep, as is Tim DeClercq, which is, if we're talking about sort of fan power, I guess it doesn't really work on Patrick Lefebvre. That's like the one thing he's in, like inoculated against. Immune to. Yeah. And then Davide Ballerini, or as Cav likes to call him, Ballero, which is just an awful anglicization of it. He's back at Astana as well, and was kind of one of his lead out guys. So Maybe maybe it'll be like Aaron Rodgers at the New York Jets, where all of his buddies come along, but then the main star doesn't turn up. There's one for all those.
Is the ballerina not a type of dance or something?
Hey?
What, ballet? Ballero?
Bolero?
Certainly not a Kaylee.
It's also the name of Castelli's, the arrow arm warmer things that go under your skin suit. The Bolero sleeves.
Of course, yeah. That must have been where I was thinking of, yeah.
Well, so you heard it here first. Cav back to Astana for 2024.
I think we're just going to report it.
Guessing this. We're just going to report it like it's actually happening. We want it to happen.
When it gets confirmed, can we then like dredge up this bit of the podcast and be like, guys, we called it mid-September.
Told you.
We were first.
Told you.
Stay tuned for more non-factual updates.
Remember last year where there was like, we got a photo of him showing up at team camp, like getting picked up in an Astana car. Remember all that? That was fun last year. Yeah.
Yeah, it was really good fun, that.
It was. We got one last little little news tidbit here. It actually relates to some of our early conversation around the Vuelta, is that Trek has come out and said, yes, we are interested in signing Primoz Roglic. GM Luca Guercellena was speaking to Marca, I believe, and yeah, confirmed the story that we wrote ahead of the Vuelta. And so if all the Yumbo reply guys could stop tweeting at me telling me that I made it up, I'd really appreciate that. That would be great. That was a confirmed story. That's why we put it on the internet. Anyway, there's your news roundup for this week. We're going to take another quick break and then come back with some listener questions. Welcome back, everybody. We've got a listener question, and we have an agony aunt for you today. I feel like we need our own name for the agony aunt section. We'll come up with something. Johnny, what's the question? Who's it from?
Good question. Who is the question from? Our listener question comes from Ben C on Discord. Remember, you can ask questions by signing up to be a member and get on Discord or emailing me. I just don't set up my alternate email to catch all the questions that are not currently arriving in my inbox, so do send them in. The listening question from Ben C is, what's the white patch on Sepp's right arm? Is there something there that needs stronger sunscreen? I have no idea what he's talking about. Kit has a hand up and knows the answer, maybe?
He's just healing from it. The healing skin from a crash is more vulnerable to sunburn than the skin that he's already got a nice strong tan on, so it needs a little bit more protection. That's my understanding.
Isn't the plaster above his eye from the crash that he had in like the last day of the tour or second last day of the tour?
Yeah, that's probably the same injury. So still healing skin, basically new skin.
That cut on the penultimate day of the Tour de France must have been pretty nasty, considering he's still wearing sort of like a butterfly bandage of some sort over his eye. Which would make sense. For anybody who listened to those daily pods, you may remember me saying something along the lines of, I just saw Sepp at the top for about 2 seconds. We were trying to interview him, but he said, I need to go find a doctor and get stitches. So he was very clear on how deep that wound was at the time. And it must have been quite nasty to still be healing at this point. I think that the elbow is probably the same thing. Yeah. Just some real epic sunscreen on a spot that was removed by the road at some point at the end of the Tour de France.
Well, there we go. Myth busting. Again, nice one, guys.
It's probably just testosterone gel, I would say. You know, just right in the elbow.
What I did, when I didn't know the answer to that question, it made me realize that I don't live in a hot enough country where I'd ever have to know this, and also that I don't ride my bike fast enough to, like, crash it. So that's great.
Johnny, may I just say you need to be aware of the dangerous effects of the sun's rays no matter where you live, and that also some of the slow speed crashes can be the worst. So
Oh, yeah, well, I just asked Mark Cavendish. That was his excuse for why it was so bad, wasn't it? That we were going slowly.
Ah, okay.
What's our agony aunt today?
Agony aunt. Before we go into it, I thought we'd decide on a name where it's agony aunt, but it's just spelt like Nicky's aunt's surname.
Oh, perfect. Yes. Okay, we did decide on that. Okay.
Might work better on paper than in a podcast, but still.
That's what I like about it, though, is that it doesn't work for a podcast yet. We're going to stick it's with it joke. Until we get told not to. It's an in-joke that everyone's in on.
So we do say agony aren't from the aunt, rather than yes. aren't.
Yep, and we did discuss doing it in a German accent, but that's where
we aren't saying aren't.
The idea becomes terrible.
Agony aren't.
Agony aren't.
What do we got?
What have we got? It comes in from a member he's emailed in with his membership number, which obviously I won't divulge because that just seems irresponsible. It comes in from Ryan. He says, Dear Nicky's aunt, I've been in a great relationship for the past few years. When I first encountered them, it was love at first sight. I knew we needed to be together. We've had some amazing times together, traveling around the country, days out by the seaside, making new friends, and lots of raucous nights out. The problem is, I've recently found my eyes wandering and head turning for other more fresh-faced competition, and there may have been a small dalliance with a former partner over the summer. I know I should be happy with what I've got, but how do I reignite that spark? I guess what I'm asking is, how do I recommit myself to being happy with my specialised athos?
Very good email.
Kind of seen what was coming. Kind of read what was going to happen there. Still easy, very, very
but
good.
Still, yeah. It was entertaining.
Yeah.
But it was very well done.
It had me questioning at one point, definitely. I thought, is this going to be something not suitable for a second podcast?
I feel like we need additional information on the former partner. What came before the athos?
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Or what are the issues with the athos? I mean, if the eye is simply wandering, is it just a matter of, you know, a new set of wheels, some new tires, perhaps something to sort of freshen it up?
I was
going to
say tires. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Go get a little makeover for the athos.
Sometimes I feel I could use some new tires. So I think it works. Yeah. It works for everyone.
Thinking about the athos and what type of bike that is, you know, being, you know, lightweight focused. Bike, perhaps setting some sort of goal that is in keeping with the spirit of that bike might then distract you from looking at other bikes that are probably going to be heavier. So maybe, I don't know, I'm not saying
hill climbing
season everything or something. Yes, hill climbing, yes.
If maybe they're in the UK, then maybe it's time to get some, I don't know, get some silverware for the athos.
I definitely think a new set of tires, maybe tan sidewall or something like that. Maybe, you know, a good deep clean all over, a bit of TLC for the athos. Maybe get the hacksaw, chop off the drops, that sort of thing. Take off one of your chain rings, remove
Don't
the front derailleur.
Drill some holes in your saddle.
Drill some holes in your saddle. Drill some holes in your levers. Yeah, I think it should rekindle the flame.
I definitely think a little retail therapy is what is required here, and yeah, a little you know, some new tidbits for your athos.
I'm not sure that's solid advice to be giving. Spend more money. I think set a goal that's going to. Yeah, but I think set a goal that's going to.
Relationships are expensive, Ronan. I don't know what you're.
I just think setting a goal for something to aim towards would maybe help him fall back in love with that
set
bike
a goal
without
and
having
drill
to spend
holes
any
in it.
Money.
You're basically losing money.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, Hill Climb Championship on the athos. There's your goal. And that should rekindle, I would think. Because it's probably the best bike you could find for that or close to it.
I can't tell if I've enjoyed or I'm like sickened by the whole like discussion in terms thing. I don't know.
I think this member should get in touch with me on Discord and we can share some thoughts back and forth on what might rekindle his love with the athos.
Mm.
Wow.
There we go. We could take
look at that.
Ryan's got relationship therapy out of this.
Yeah.
One-on-one. Ryan, thank you for sending that question in. That's a superb question.
Yeah.
And just as a reminder, you can send us your Agony Aunt questions on Discord or straight to Johnny Long, johnny.long@escapecollective.com. J-O-N-N-Y, no H.
Just as a reminder, J-O-N-N-Y, long. Keep them cycling related, not relationship related.
Either way, I just...
Whatever you
want
to do.
Just don't want them to be, like, very blokey. That's the one rule. Not blokey, because it'll make me feel sick.
All right, it's time for our weekly pain. As a reminder, the current standings, Kit in the lead with 5 points, Dane and Johnny tied with 4, Ian with 1, not here, not going to gain anything today, and Ronan, you still got 0, unfortunately for you. The game today is Price is Right rules. So you're going to give me a number related to the question that I ask, and you cannot go over the real number, the answer number. Those are Price is Right rules, right? Reverse Maya Sabla rules, basically. So, for example, if the answer to this question that I'm going to ask is 100 and you say 99, you have a very good chance of winning. If you say 101, you have no chance of winning. Each of you is going to put in a bid, and I will let you know who wins. The question, of course, is going to be Sepkus related. So, at the West Yellowstone Super Tour 2009 Sprint Qualifier Nordic Ski Race, Sepkus finished in what position? I will give you one additional hint, which is that there were 120 athletes in this particular race. Please provide your bet. Or your bet? Your guess. We're going to start with you, Johnny. What position did Sepkus finish at the West Yellowstone Sprint Qualifiers in 2009?
I'm not going to give my reasoning so as not to tip off my rivals. I'm going to go with a conservative 56th.
56th, all right. Ronan, what do you think?
Is this an age group race, or is this, what kind of race is this?
This is, yeah, it's a junior race.
Oh,
all
well.
Of the, no, sorry, it is juniors and U23s all combined.
Oh, well, that changes.
See, Johnny, there's a lesson for
adults.
You. There's a lesson for you. Working together is better for everyone, Johnny. Teamwork. Makes a team. So you've already made your guess and you excluded us from your rationale. So there you go. One further question.
Unbelievable.
I'm confused as to how it would work if someone picks win, like the first place, because how do you go under the
Sep didn't win. Okay. I'll tell you that right now.
Okay, that okay.
The guy that won was in the Olympics for Nordic skiing quite recently. So those are the people who won this. And Sep is a very good skier, but he was not that good a skier. What do you think?
I'm going to say 23rd.
We got 56th, we got 23rd. I'm going to write these down so I don't forget.
Kit? I have no idea. I'm just going to imagine he was quite good.
That is,
do any of us have an idea?
Amazing.
Yeah,
no, I know.
If you had any idea, this would be no fun.
This is very true. Okay, well, I'll just say the first number that popped into my head, which probably has nothing to do with Chris at all, 13.
13. You have high standards for Sepkus. The actual result, so in 2009, Sepkus would have been a junior racing a whole bunch of much older individuals. He finished 97th out of 125, and so therefore Johnny wins this point.
Do I get a fan club card?
You don't.
Johnny, your negativity has once again rewarded you.
Why change?
There'll be 3 questions here, and if we end up with a draw of some sort, then of course we have rules in place to deal with that, which is fine. your next question. The headline of this piece is Sep Kuss leads Durango Steamers. U14er Sep Kuss has been busy this winter, the story says. Besides skiing full-time for the Durango Nordic Ski Club, Sep has led the Durango Steamers of the Bantam B Hockey Southwest League with how many goals?
Oh,
can we...
How many goals did Sep Kuss score?
Which publication did this story appear in?
I'm not telling you. You can't look it up.
I'm not going
to
look it up.
I thought Ronan was inquiring as to the journalistic rigor of the local newspapers in Durango.
No, this is actually on the Durango Devo website, which is the mountain bike Devo program, the development program here in Durango that has created... There's a photo that I put up on my Instagram today, actually, that is Sep Kuss and Howard Gratz, who was an Olympian in Rio, as like 13-year-olds in Durango Devo. It's created quite a lot of talent, or ushered through quite a lot of talent. So,
but
how many goals?
We're talking about hockey, yeah.
Yes, how many how many hockey goals did Sep Kuss score for the U14
Bantams? Yeah, that's what I was
going to
ask. How many games? And then how many goals did you typically score in a hockey game?
Well,
ice hockey.
Yeah, ice hockey.
Ice hockey. What other kind of hockey?
Well, we play field hockey in the UK because we don't get
ice. You're speaking to three people who only know how to fall down on ice.
Ice hockey, 9 games.
Oh, okay.
The average score of a hockey game is usually like 3 to 5 or something.
Yeah. This is about like...
Actually, that's probably a bit high even.
Yeah,
it's a bit high. I don't know. I'm not a hockey player.
Junior hockey.
And he was the leading scorer for this team.
He was the leading scorer on his team. He played 9 games. How many goals did he score?
They could have sucked. They could have been the worst team.
They had one goal and he scored it.
They're actually second in their division behind Telluride.
Oh, those goddamn Telluride something. I can't even think. I'm so non-American. I can't even think of what you'd call the Telluride junior hockey franchise.
We're going to start with Kit. How many goals? We're going to go over the other direction.
Tell you goals.
And again, it's Price is Right. So if you go over, you're out of luck. But if you're under, you're all right.
I'll go 18.
18 goals.
Wow.
That's a solid. He's a good
top
hockey
scorer.
Player.
I don't know.
Ronan.
I'm going to say 5.
So they're not a good team in Ronan's imagination.
I think they have many goal scorers.
Yeah, but he's the top one.
Logically.
Yeah, okay, carry on.
My answer is 6.
Ronan gets the point. He scored exactly 5 goals.
Wow.
For the Bantam B Southwest, or for the Durango Steamers in the Bantam B Hockey Southwest League.
I remember
7
well.
Assists.
See, this
five
is
goals,
I,
seven
my experience with hockey
games
is letting in 19 goals in a game when I was a goalkeeper. Yeah, I was.
Was Sep Kuss playing?
All right. Final question. Johnny, 1 point. Ronan, 1 point. Kit, 0 points at the moment. So at the moment, you two are sharing. It's a draw, and you get one big point each. Your final question. We're going back to the West Yellowstone Super Tour. Going back to the West Yellowstone Super Tour 2009 sprint qualifier. This was, I believe, I want to say 2K, 1.5K event. Doesn't actually say. But based on the times, that's what I'm guessing. So you have to guess the time of Sep Kuss in this event.
What's this Nordic skiing?
Yeah, Nordic skiing. We're back at the.
I wondered if he had another sport in his background.
Yeah. Is this the same Nordic skiing? Same race that he finished 92nd.
Yeah, same race. He finished 97th.
So it's probably about 2 kilometers. I've never seen anyone do Nordic skiing because I live in like a proper place. Like we've got other things to
so
do.
So I'll provide a hint. I'll provide a hint for all three of you.
A warmer
I'll provide a hint for all three of you. Nordic ski speeds tend to be quite similar to like mountain bike speeds, like mountain bike cross country racing speeds.
That doesn't help me.
Yeah.
And I think this looks to me like a 2K sprint. So over 2K, how long did it take? We're going to start with...
Do you remember that episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire where the guy asking the question was like, it kind of looks like this is a question to me, but I'm not sure exactly what question we're asking here. No, knew that. It never happened.
Do you want me to repeat the question? Would you like to...
We need you to know what the actual distance was.
How long did Sepp Kuss take to ski, probably 2 kilometers, at the sprint qualifier in 2009? Ronan, you're first. You've got to give me a minutes and a seconds.
I have no idea. I'm going to say 2 kilometers. Well, he wasn't doing 30K an hour, which would be 4 minutes. I don't know, was he doing 15K an hour? He finished 97th, so he was well down in the winter. 8 minutes, 0 seconds, and 3/100ths of a second.
Johnny?
I'm going to go 8 minutes flat.
Kit?
I'm going to go conservative this time, which might not be the right move, but I have absolutely not a clue. So Ronnie's got his hand up.
I it's a bit late now, but just to ensure that Johnny doesn't win, I am going to ask a follow-up question, and that is, what is Nordic skiing? Because if it involves hills, I would like to change my time.
Nah, well...
It does. Like flat, it does involve hills, but the sprints often don't. Sprints are often quite flat, or we'll have like one little hill in them.
I was hoping that would help, but it didn't. I'm just gonna pull a number out of my ass and say
7:59. I thought that's what was being cooked up.
Unfortunately, all of you went way over. Now that I look at this, it was potentially more like a 1.5K. It doesn't say on the result sheet.
Not that that would have helped, to be honest.
It doesn't say on the result sheet. His time in the West Yellowstone Super Tour 2009 sprint qualifier was 5 minutes,
what?
23 seconds, 24. So I, as a not particularly good Nordic skier, I have finished Nordic ski races with average speeds of like 25K an hour.
Your boasting here doesn't help us, Kitty.
I'm just saying that, like, it may be a 2K. It all depends on the course, right? It all depends on the course. So no points for anybody that round. So that leaves us with a draw between Ronan and Johnny. No points for you, Kit. Let's update the score sheet. We've got the overall results after this week's episode. We now have Kit and Johnny tied for first, followed by Dane in second, and Ian and Ronan tied for third.
Do I get a full point for a draw, or do I get half a point?
You get 1 point for a draw.
Yeah. Weekly Pain lived up to its name this week.
Yeah, now I just want to know, Johnny, are you a Roglic or a Vingegaard?
Roglic.
Oh, bastard. I'm screwed.
Have you not seen my massive tattoo of the little Celtic cross on my forearm?
All right, it's time for us to wrap up today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Make sure you get in your Agony Aunt questions over to Johnny. If you've got any other questions, you can always hit us with those in the placeholders section of Discord, or email any of us or tweet us or whatever.
No Nordic skiing questions, please.
You can ask as many more Nordic skiing questions as you want. We're going to do an entire Nordic skiing section over the winter. We're just going to talk Nordic skiing, nothing but Nordic skiing. It's going to be great. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week with another episode. Bye-bye.
Today's correct answers are Alberto Dainese, Jared Drizners, Davide Cimolai, Juan Sebastian Milano, and Rui Oliveira.
Well, that's obvious. All right, we're going to play out on something that I dug up while looking for Sepp Kuss's hockey results and skiing results. This is a song about the 2008 Durango Devo team race schedule. Enjoy.
Devo team race schedule. Devo team race schedule. 2008. April 12th and 13th in Fruta. May 2nd through the 4th in Mathrin.
What?
22nd in Crested Butte.
I love Crested Butte.
July 11th to the 13th in Snowmass. In August 1st to the 3rd in Telluride.
Yes!
Crested State Championships. Then to finish it off, September 6th through 7th in Breckenridge.
No!
There's a stage.
It's gonna be fun.